first to Alabama, where at least one county, Mobile, is not issuing any marriage licenses at all, gay or straight, while the state grapples with competing court decisions on gay marriage. Last night, the Alabama Supreme Court upheld that state's ban on same-sex marriage in defiance of an earlier federal court ruling that overturned the ban. John Archibald is columnist for the Birmingham News, AL.com. And John, how would you describe what's going on in Alabama right now?
Well, it's certainly chaos right now as people try to figure out whether their marriages are legal, whether they can get married as planned, what goes forward from here. It's really up in the air in a lot of our 67 counties.
Well, let's just remind ourselves, Alabama's same-sex marriage ban was approved by voters in 2006 by 81%. So 81% of the voters there wanted to have the ban on same-sex marriage. What are they saying about this back and forth in the courts?
Well, that certainly depends on which side you're on. In Jefferson County here in Birmingham, it's a little bit more evenly divided than that. I think a lot of people have come to the conclusion that, you know, times have changed and gay marriage is marriage, although there's a hardcore that really disagrees with that quite a bit. But that all seemed a little bit like water over the dam in February when we started to legalize gay marriage and people began to celebrate on the grounds that were once, you know, civil rights landmarks. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like we had gone beyond that.
That was in the federal court ruling that overturned the ban.
That was in Judge Grenade's federal court ruling, mm-hmm. Correct. And as a result of that, hundreds and hundreds of gay couples were married across Alabama, and we anticipated that this would all be settled in June in the U.S. Supreme Court. Only the Alabama Supreme Court decided to weigh in.
Right.
Unexpectedly.
Well, and as we said last night, they did weigh in and overturned the ban of the ban, if you will. But you mentioned the U.S. Supreme Court. They could, as you say, still review your state's Supreme Court ruling. But the Supreme Court is already going to issue a ruling in June on whether states can ban same-sex marriage and refuse to recognize gay marriages performed in other states. So that ruling is still ahead. Meanwhile, what does this mean? We mentioned Mobile is saying, the heck with it. We're not going to issue any licenses today. Are there other states that are doing the same? What's happening? I mean, rather county. Are there other counties that are issuing no licenses? Are there any counties that are taking it into their hands to issue gay marriage licenses? What's going on?
I don't have a full count. As I said, we have 67 counties, and some of them are difficult, but we know that Jefferson County, which is the home to Birmingham, and Mobile County, which is obviously home to Mobile, are not issuing. And if those two are not issuing, it's likely that none are issuing. I have yet to come across a county that is actually issuing gay marriage licenses today. Not to say that there's not one out there, but it doesn't appear that that's the case.
Well, you mentioned, you know, somewhat sacred ground that's there in Alabama. This weekend, people are gathering to commemorate the 50 years since the March on Selma that, of course, led to voting rights. George Wallace stood on the steps of a university and fought integration. Alabama is the heart of states' rights and at the heart of civil rights. So, you know, how else is this reverberating there?
Well, there are many people who look at that, you know, with not just a little irony. I mean, 50 years ago, we had people denying the rights to others on the basis of the fact that they'd never had those rights. And really, a lot of people are reading the same sort of thing into the Alabama Supreme Court decision. I mean, which in essence says you can't have the right to marry because you've never had the right to marry. And there are many, many people are seeing similarities in those two incidents.
Well, meanwhile, in the minute we have today's politics, yesterday's state Supreme Court ruling, again, upholding the voter-backed ban on gay marriage, came out last night during the Republican Governor Robert Bentley's State of the State address. What do we take from that?
Yes, it did. The big question today is whether that was an intentional thing. And, of course, it's hard to imagine that it wasn't an intentional thing. It was scheduled. The thing about it is the governor who ran as a no-new-taxes Republican and has been such his entire career, was announcing about a $700 million tax increase because the state is in dire straits. And there are many in his party who obviously control the state who are unhappy with that. And so there's some speculation, some thought that maybe this ruling was timed in such a way as to nip that in the bud.
John Archibald, columnist for the Birmingham News, AL.com. John, thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
House Speaker John Boehner's job is safe for now. Boehner survived another confrontation with rebellious conservative Republicans yesterday, pushing through a bill that funds the Department of Homeland Security for the rest of the budget year. 167 Republicans, though, voted against that legislation and on the opposite side of Speaker Boehner. And there are more ideological fights on the horizon. Boehner is not the first GOP House Speaker to face a rebellion, though, although it has been a while. Joshua Spivak is a senior fellow at the Hugh Carey Institute for Government Reform at Wagner College. He writes the Recall Election blog, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's go back to the last Speaker of the House to be ousted from that role, and that would be Newt Gingrich. This is back in 1998 after he had to resign his speakership.
Having led the party to three consecutive victories in terms of having a majority in the House, the only time in 70 years we've done that, I could hardly stand by and allow the party to cannibalize itself in that situation. And I thought it was best for all of us. Marianne and I have lots of things to do, and I've already talked to a lot of people today about opportunities to do some more learning and maybe earn a little bit of money.
So take us back to that moment. It was an eternity ago in politics. What happened? What brought him down?
Well, Gingrich was already facing a lot of trouble. He was this revolutionary leader for the Republicans who brought them out of the wilderness after almost 40 years of being in the minority. And suddenly they didn't like how he was governing. And in 1997, a number of Republicans, including John Boehner, tried to oust him in a coup. But that failed. And the leader of the coup, Bill Paxon, actually had to resign. But Gingrich then had a very poor showing in the 98 elections. The Republicans did not increase their majority, as you would expect in the sixth year of a presidential term from the opposite party. Instead, they lost seats, and they were very disappointed in him, and they were going to toss him out, it seemed. And so he didn't run for re-election to the speakership, and suddenly he was out of Congress. He quit Congress very shortly after that.
But as you point out, he was just the latest in a string of Republican leaders in the House to be ousted from their position in the 20th century.
Yes, there were a number prior to him. The first was Joe Cannon. He didn't actually lose the speakership. He lost all the power of the speakership. That was way back in 1910, and it really reshaped the House.
Is he the person that the Cannon office building is named after?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And then in more recent years, the Republicans kept losing. They lost their House majority in 54, and then they quickly overthrew the former Speaker, House Minority Leader. The House Minority Leader is the equivalent to the Speaker on the other side.
Right.
So Joseph Martin was ousted by Charles Halleck, who was then himself ousted by Gerald Ford. So there was a history of doing this. And in fact, Gingrich, when he was leading his revolt in 94, he told the minority leader, Robert Michael, that he was going to take the seat from him.
Meanwhile, Democrats have a very different history when it comes to getting rid of people in their own leadership. They tend to stand behind their leaders.
Yeah, Democrats are very supportive of their leaders, it seems. Even though they're kind of always thought of as the more unruly party, it's not the case in the House. So Nancy Pelosi lost the majority in 2010. She kept the seat pretty easily. And in 2014, the Democrats did very poorly, but she kept it. Dick Gephardt was the majority leader in the House in 94, and the Democrats got wiped out. It was really their worst showing in decades, in 40 years. And yet he was named minority leader.
Well, why do you think that is? Why do they hold on to these people after big losses?
I guess they like the continuity. They don't blame that person, it seems, for the loss. They take maybe a longer view that this official is not the one who takes the blame. Also, there's possibly a benefit in that the party may rip itself apart in the election of a new leader. That's always a danger, and that could be a danger here for the Republicans. If John Boehner was kicked out, who would replace him? Well, it would be a pretty big fight, potentially.
Joshua Spivak, senior fellow at the Hugh Carey Institute for Government Reform at Wagner College. We'll link you to his blog at our website, hereandnow.org. Joshua Spivak, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Jeremy.
This week, Venezuela's government ordered the U.S. Embassy in Caracas to come up with a plan within the next 2 weeks to cut staff by more than 80%. The government also barred Americans from entering the country without a visa. It's the latest diplomatic flare-up between the government of President Nicolas Maduro and the United States. And with us now to talk about it, via Skype from Caracas, is Brian Ellsworth, senior correspondent for Reuters. Brian, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks.
Well, what brought about these changes?
It's largely been the result of recent accusations by Venezuela that the United States is seeking to promote a coup against Maduro. The United States denies this, but there's obviously diplomatic implications for those type of accusations. And yes, of course, this has gone back a long way. The two countries have not gotten along great since 2002. There was a coup against former President Hugo Chavez. The Bush administration provided tacit support for that coup, then backtracked when Chavez was quickly restored to power. So relations have not for a long time been particularly good.
But what's the significance of asking for a reduction in diplomatic staff in the country?
The U.S. Embassy, particularly among supporters of the government, has been seen as basically a place of conspiracy. Obviously, there's a long history of United States supporting military governments and backing in one way or another efforts to remove leftist governments. So there is certainly history there. And in general, among sort of rank and file government supporters, many would see that as a place where the CIA is active or where people are seeking to undermine the government in one way or another. Of course, the United States denies these accusations, and a lot of folks would believe that they are intentionally exaggerated for political effect. But when they talk about reducing staff, in part, they say, why does the United States have such a large diplomatic presence here when we have a relatively small diplomatic presence there? I think there's a lot of political undertones to it. So it plays well to a domestic audience, and that's probably in part why they're doing that.
And what about the new restrictions for ordinary people? Americans who want to travel to Venezuela are going to have to apply for a visa and pay a fee, which, by the way, Americans have to do already in countries like Brazil, which many other people from other countries don't have to do.
Yes, that's true. We're not entirely sure why that happened and why they chose to do that. What they said is that they had detained a group of people that were accused of espionage. These, we believe, were four missionaries from North Dakota who were involved in a health operation along the coast of Venezuela. They denied having any involvement in it. They left the country. And those two things happened at the same time. They may have been on tourist visas, which perhaps spurred the government to make this decision about requiring that people apply for tourist visas. I don't think it would make it more likely that Americans would travel to Venezuela,
right.
But I don't think it's a particularly common destination at this point, just because people have security concerns and there are just other places that your average tourist would probably be more likely to go to, perhaps Aruba or Trinidad.
Well, Brian Ellsworth, give us a sense of what it's like there in Venezuela, because we know, for example, that there has been rampant inflation that has created this entire black market for people to get the money they need to buy ordinary things.
Yes, this is a controlled economy, and it's been that way for more than 10 years now, controlled in the sense that there are a lot of government controls on prices, exchange rates, and many of the corporations that distribute basic goods are owned by the state. It functioned relatively well when oil prices were high. Now that oil prices are low, it's getting a lot harder to maintain that structure. So what we're seeing are considerable number of product shortages, which generally rotate between different things. You'll see some days you won't find wheat flour, corn flour, then a couple weeks go by and other things are missing, things like dish soap, toilet paper, detergent. These kinds of things end up being difficult to find, so they become commodities. So people buy and sell them in informal transactions that you wouldn't see in a place like the United States, because people would simply buy them at the supermarket. Dollars have taken on sort of the same significance. They are obviously a way of saving and protecting yourself against inflation. So people do buy and sell them on black markets, and it makes it difficult for people who need to import goods or services or who need to travel.
So given all of that, how are people feeling in Venezuela? Is the Maduro government likely to last for a while, or?
Well, the Maduro government was elected in 2013. His term expires in 2019. The next potential moment that he could be removed by election would be a recall referendum, which wouldn't be able to happen until 2016, if I'm not mistaken. And there's always talk of coups and military intervention. Most people who look at it closely don't think that's likely, simply because the armed forces are most of them, I would say, support the government, and I think the remainder don't want to be involved in politics, and they understand that coups these days are not particularly well seen around the world, and I don't think they are interested in being at the head of a military government that would be seen as illegitimate.
That's Brian Ellsworth, who's the senior correspondent for Reuters in Caracas, Venezuela. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's turn now to West Africa, where there are some signs Ebola is abating, others that it's not. There are fewer new cases overall, but people are still getting infected. Sick fishermen came ashore recently in Sierra Leone, producing new cases and deaths, adding to the nearly 10,000 people who've died from Ebola in Africa, more than 4,000 of them in Liberia, where many close-knit communities have been shattered. The BBC's Africa correspondent Andrew Harding reports.
Ebola survivors gather in Monrovia's city hall, some in celebration, others in tears. In the crowd is 28-year-old Siani Bayan.
Ebola changed everything. Everything turned around with me. Nothing good going on in my life. Everything just hard for me.
Do you think you can turn it around again and make things better?
Yes, I will try.
For now, Siani has a job at an Ebola center, the same place her own life was saved.
I couldn't see, I couldn't talk, I couldn't walk. I was just dead and done.
For months, this has been at the heart of the fight against Ebola, the giant Elwa 3 MSF compound, 250 beds operating here. But now, for the first time since the outbreak started, we've had three entirely clear days with no Ebola patients here whatsoever.
The result? A bulldozer is already dismantling some of the structures. By the end of the month, Siani will be out of a job. To complicate matters further, her husband has rejected her.
He said, "You don't want me because I got Ebola. You don't want Ebola woman. I just alone."
She must now raise three children on her own.
No partner to help me, no family member, no friends. So it really worries me. It worries me how I will manage to bring the children up to pay my rent. So it worries me a lot.
An evangelical choir sings beneath the trees on the outskirts of Monrovia. Siani has just moved into the neighbourhood. It's the third time she's had to change homes. It's not just her husband who doesn't want to live alongside an Ebola survivor.
We pray for Ebola to leave this country, but not that they can bring the Ebola patient to here, no. They don't bring them here. We don't accept Ebola patients because we're afraid. We don't even want to see them. But we pray that the sickness, the virus should leave this country. That's all.
People just bless me with this mattress here that will lie down.
So even the mattress isn't yours?
No.
This is the mat we lie down.
We're inside a tiny, dark little room that Siana has been renting for the last few weeks, and she's staying here on a mattress, tiny mattress that she and her three children share. And I can see her few pots and pans and a big poster of Jesus on the wall.
So if I go in expensive room, I will not be able to do a lot of things that I'm supposed to do for the children.
Well, most schools have opened or are reopening here in Liberia, but Josephine, aged 7, and Joseph, aged 11, are not going back to school. They say their mother, living on her own now with them, simply can't afford to send them. What do you want to be when you're big?
I'll be engineer.
Engineer? And when did you last go to school?
Last year.
So you miss school?
Come on, man, I get money.
Your mum needs to get the money so you can go back. Liberia may be near the end of the Ebola crisis. A paralysed economy seems poised to spring back to life, a sense of relief and opportunity on the streets. But if the big picture is starting to look encouraging, Siani's family is proof of Ebola's devastating legacy.
The BBC's Andrew Harding reporting. The retail giant Target announced this week that it is cutting several thousand jobs, most of which at the company's headquarters in Minnesota. The company says this is part of a restructuring plan under a new CEO who took over last year after that embarrassing data breach during the 2013 holiday season. Sucharita Molperu watches the retail industry for Forrester Research. She's with us now to discuss. Sucharita, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy.
So what is behind this cost-cutting plan and all these job cuts?
Well, I don't think that a restructuring in itself is all that alarming. Anytime a company does find that it wants to, you know, sort of have a clean slate and start over again in a competitive environment, you'll see a restructuring. You'll see a number of layoffs and, kind of potentially some organizational structural changes. And, just the ability to go back and, kind of organize the company as the new CEO thinks is the best way to organize the company.
So this doesn't have anything to do, you don't think, with the security breach that we all remember at Target back in 2013?
The security breach was probably one of the biggest PR disasters in retail in recent memory. However, the interesting thing is that the security breach hasn't really been that bad for Target overall. The reason that I say that is that even from a financial loss standpoint, Target recorded a charge of about $150 or $160 million, which is a large amount, but not large when you consider the fact that the company is well over a $70 billion retailer annually. And it actually had a bigger flop with the closure of its stores in Canada. I think that that was a bigger issue for the company. That was actually a significantly larger charge of several billion dollars.
What does the Target of the future look like, and how is it different from, let's say, Walmart?
Well, I think that one of the things that Target has struggled with is the differentiation in its merchandising strategy. And historically, you know, kind of at the height of Target in, say, like the 90s and even the earlier part of the 2000s, Target was really, really known for unique merchandise that was very special and, kind of gave it the Target feel.
Right.
Right. And, they lost a bit of that. And while it was a successful launch into grocery, you know, when you kind of go into those mass commodities, it leaves in some ways less room for, you know, the special merchandise, you know, the flair in home goods or in apparel. So I think that in the future, they'll likely head back to some of those special launches. You know, we'll see, you know, kind of those timed special releases of merchandise that are only available at Target for a limited time period. Hopefully they won't crash any websites like they have in the past. And that brings me probably to the other big area of investment, which is digital. I mean, we're seeing increased investment in digital. Their biggest competitor right now, in addition to Walmart, is actually Amazon.
Right.
And they need to make sure that they're on par. I mean, they definitely put a stake in the ground. They decreased their shipping threshold, which was big news. They it used to be, I think, around $50. And now you can can buy at Target.com if your basket is $25. It's actually lower than Amazon's for non-Prime customers and lower than Walmart's. So, you know, so they definitely want to win in the web channel.
Sucharita Mulparu with Forrester Research. Sucharita, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
On Friday, the movie Chappie opens. It's about a futuristic police robot that becomes self-conscious, not the kind of robot that exists now. Today's robots can be flummoxed by a door or a foot rail. Well, at Carnegie Mellon University, scientists are working on a new robot that better understands the human environment. From our tech partner IEEE Spectrum, Prachi Patel reports.
A strange-looking contraption that looks like a laptop perched on a wheeled stool wanders the hallways of Carnegie Mellon University's computer science building. Sometimes it greets visitors.
I am here to guide you to room 7002. Please press done when you are ready to go.
That is Cobot. Press a button on Cobot's screen and it takes off down the hallway, turning corners and stopping for people, guiding you to where you need to go.
Please follow me to room 7203.
In this case, computer science professor Manuela Veloso's office.
My view is the following, that robots, these mechanical creatures, will coexist with humans. They will coexist without having to be joysticked or remote controlled. They will be autonomous. They will be around us, helping us with our decisions, helping us with our tasks. They will be part of our life.
That means getting around on their own. A trivial task for humans, but pretty complicated for machines. Robots can't always identify objects, and they're thrown off by rearranged tables. Take the nimble Roomba. It can't tell a table from a chair, and it certainly has no idea where the bedroom is or how to get there, or that it's in the living room right now. The problem is robots don't have a biological GPS like humans do, says Veloso's PhD student, Joydeep Biswas.
So when I ask you to go to the elevator, you know exactly how to go to the elevator. But what is this representation of this map in your mind? You don't know. Neurologists and psychologists are trying to figure out how we're doing this, but we don't know.
So how do we teach a computer to do that task? For starters, fit it with a camera and some sensors to constantly observe its environment and log those observations. Biswas points to Cobot's screen that shows what the bot sees.
So those blue lines that you see is its map of the world, and those are essentially the walls in the building. These red dots over here are you and me.
Cobot has a basic map built in, but to know where it is in that map, it takes into account every object around it. It considers whether they are permanent features like walls, movable ones like doors, or things like tables. And then it does sophisticated computations with that data to figure out where it is in the building. It employs other tricks too. If it spots a chair, it goes back to its data log to find where it has seen a similar object before. And it's always learning.
The exact location of your chair in your office might not be the same every day. However, it is most likely to be in front of your table, right? So if you can keep track of how these objects move over time, that gives you some information.
Cobot can also recognize humans. It will politely move sideways to pass them or say, excuse me, if they're blocking its way. It has logged over 1,000 kilometers moving on its own, escorting people and delivering things. But it can't do everything.
After some time, I realized that these robots inevitably have limitations, cognitive, perceptual, actuation limitations.
Again, Carnegie Mellon's Manuela Veloso.
And if they would have arms, they still would not be able to open all the doors of the world. They still would not be able to pick up any object in the world.
So Cobot uses a simple trick when stumped. It asks the nearest human for help.
Could you please press the down button for the elevator and let me know when the elevator is here?
Veloso says programming a robot to ask for help is easier than teaching it to parse language or giving it fine motor skills. She calls the concept symbiotic autonomy, a brave new world of human-machine partnership.
Waiting to receive your next meeting location.
For Here and Now, I'm Prachi Patel in Pittsburgh.
Okay, let's go.
And Prachi's story comes to us from our tech partner IEEE Spectrum. We've got a video of Cobot the robot at hereandnow.org.
Well, movie lovers have the Academy Awards, television fans the Emmys. For those who love the really small screen, it's the International Mobile Gaming Awards. Mobile games. Alec Baldwin got tossed off a plane for playing Words with Friends. Kevin Spacey's character was seen playing Monument Valley in the hip House of Cards. And that's the game, Monument Valley, that took first place last night at the 11th annual IMGA ceremony in San Francisco, honoring the best entertainment apps for cell phones and other mobile devices. Neil McFarland is director of Games for Us Too. That's the British company that makes Monument Valley. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And the Grand Prix, what does that mean for you?
It just means so much to us. Not only to win in a category, but to win a Grand Prix prize is massively exciting for us. And we're really pleased that that people are accepting us and enjoying the game.
Does it translate into more dollars?
Hopefully, yes. We'll start finding out in the next couple of days. We've been out there for a little over, almost a year now. So we've done quite well in that time. In terms of revenue, we've a little over $6 million in revenue. We're very pleased with how things have gone.
Well, $6 million in revenue. These games are less expensive than console games. So how many is that downloaded?
Well, without me doing the maths in my head right now, the game sells for $4.
It's
a multiple of that.
Yeah, so we can say that's a lot of games. And talk to us a little bit about the appeal. I'm looking at the game on an app. It's a puzzle game. It's based on these mind-bending images of the artist M.C. Escher. I'm looking at a character, and the goal of the player is to get this character to climb up this unbelievable building, and the parts of the building move around as she climbs. What more were you trying to do with this game?
Well, it is a she, yes. We call her Princess Ida. She is trying to get to the top of these monuments, and there's a story that unfolds. So there is a narrative to the whole game. But, we were actually trying to reach a very broad audience. We've all been playing games most of our lives, so therefore have seen a lot of different types of games and have become sort of jaded with it in some respects, but still looking for new things and are still surprised. So what we wanted to do was maybe produce a game that we could excite a broad range of people, and specifically people that would call themselves non-gamers. So we tried to make something that was could be instantly appealing, very clean design, not too much going on in the way of user interface, and wasn't in any way scary for someone to pick up and have a go at.
Well, is it also the look of it? It's just beautiful and sleek. It is based on artwork. Does it reflect a tension between people who make your kind of game and, let's say, Kim Kardashian's Hollywood, or Angry Birds? Within the industry, do you think of yourself more as an artist?
I would say we definitely approach it that way, yes. I mean, as in the film industry or maybe in literature, there are a range of books and authors for different tastes.
Well, what do you think about projections for mobile games? According to an article in TechCrunch, Newzoo predicts that mobile is going to outpace the console industry this year. That's console games like PlayStation or Xboxes. And then by 2017, mobile games are going to be 30% bigger in sales than console games. What do you think about that?
In some ways, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, everyone has a smartphone, or most people have a smartphone in their pocket, so the barrier to entry is lowered in that respect. You're buying the phone anyway. You're not having to buy a specialist piece of equipment, so it sort of wins on that front. And as the power of the phones increases, the performance and the graphics comes closer to the console market anyway. So for a whole host of reasons, it doesn't seem unreasonable to think that mobile gaming can overtake the console market, because it's just easier to do for the end user.
Well, but I know that there are those saying right now to their listening device, no way will mobile handheld games ever compete with Grand Theft Auto and all the graphic design and work that goes into that, and they say justifies the higher price.
There's no dispute there, but it's the same reason why I might go and watch a film at the IMAX cinema, whereas I'd be happy to watch way more films on download on my TV at home. I think there's a place for everything, and some blockbuster things will always draw the attention and have a place on console. But there's a huge audience for all kinds of different other titles that can be serviced on a smartphone.
For when you're waiting in the airport. Neil McFarland, director of Games for Us Too. Their game Monument Valley just won the Grand Prix at the International Mobile Gaming Awards last night in San Francisco. Neil, thank you.
No, thank you.
And Jeremy, we've been invited by listener Steve Lambert to play Words with Friends with him. Should we give in?
Do people still play Words with Friends?
Steve apparently does. I just know I'd be the one kicked off the airplane. I wouldn't be able to stop. But Steve, bring it. Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, his rambling, hate-filled blueprint for the Third Reich, will be in German bookstores for the first time in almost 70 years when a new annotated edition of the book is published in Germany in January 2016. After World War II, the occupying Allies banned the book and the rights passed to Bavaria, but the copyright expires at the end of this year, and all 16 German states have agreed that the book can be re-released as long as it contains annotations. But even with the 4,000 or so expected footnotes, there have been protests. A spokesperson for the Jewish Forum for Democracy Against Anti-Semitism in Berlin said, "Can you annotate the devil?" The new version is being published by the well-respected Institute of Contemporary History in Munich. Magnus Breschkin joins us now. And Magnus, can you annotate the devil?
Well, we are an academic institute who is founded after the Second World War to do research on the origins of National Socialism and Third Reich. And all what Hitler has been written and published between 1925 and 1933 is already available as a critical annotated edition. So there's just one gap, and this gap is, as you mentioned, Mein Kampf. So we are filling this gap with a critical annotated edition of a historical text amidst all the other texts which are already available.
Well, but how do you address what some would say are just crazy statements about Jews, for instance? It's one thing to annotate for historical references, but how do you annotate insanity?
Well, Hitler's writings are taking up historical discourses of the time and of previous decades. Modern anti-Semitism came up in the second part of the 19th century. And he's not the only one who's writing in the 1920s about anti-Semitism, eugenics, racism, and so on. And what we are doing is to show where these ideas come from, where the formulations come from, where other sources lie that have formulated this racism and anti-Semitism previously, and where he and how he amalgamates these ideas to some sort of a political program. And with this, we can then explain why a text which nowadays, if you read it in 2015, sounds very strange and very foreign and not very really understandable, was connecting with many people at the time in the 1920s. It was connecting because people at the time had this as something which was part of their everyday life.
This anti-Semitism and this hatred. The book was dictated by Adolf Hitler to Rudolf Hess when the two were imprisoned after the Nazis' failed coup in Munich in 1923. Even Hitler said later, "Had I known I'd rise to lead the country, I never would have written the book." But pull one line out, as the New York Times recently did. Here's a line that they say is just plain, you know, balmy. "The Judaization of our spiritual life and the mammonization of our mating impulse sooner or later befouls our entire new generation." What would you do with that?
Well, this is part of a racist, social Darwinist, and also imperialist discourse, which has been going on for several decades. You will find similar formulations with other authors at this time or also previous to the First World War. What is new with Hitler is that he amalgamates this into a political program and puts this at the forefront of what he sees as his worldview or ideology, and that he really wants to put this into practice.
Well, others have written, I'm looking at Guy Walters, who wrote the book Hunting Evil, who wrote in the Telegraph, the hope that what you are doing will in effect be an academic demolition of Hitler's words, death by footnote. Mm-hmm. But do you worry that footnotes and the idea that you've expressed that this will be put in the context of the time will actually give more credence to twisted minds who might be looking to this book for the blueprint that he intended it?
If someone wants to read Mein Kampf now, then he or she can do this. The English version has never been out of print. And the same is more or less true for the German text. And if you type in Hitler Mein Kampf PDF at any search engine on the internet, you will have the text available in German within a few seconds. So the text is available, and what he or she cannot do is get sufficient historically based information of really what lies behind the text. And that is what we are delivering.
You are a publisher. You're, again, a well-respected institute of contemporary history in Munich. I'm imagining that you would agree with those who say that to ban a book is what makes it more desirous. To publish it is, you know, in this case, to read it and mock it.
Yeah, it is already happening, what you say, that there is a lot of speculation and myth what's in the text and whether the book should be read or not. If the book is available and you will read it, you will find it quite boring and it's not very well written, but make it available, discuss the background, and we have trust that the civil society in Germany and other places will be able to deal with such a text.
Magnus Brechtin of the Institute of Contemporary History in Munich. They are working on the annotations now for the new release of Mein Kampf in January 2016 in Germany. Magnus, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks.